Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping seven and eight-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. Good to have you with me on the show today. What's going on? It's summertime, beautiful. I've been getting outside a lot, which is really fun. Will Roman from Cheezos Boots was on the road, stopped through town recently, had a lot of fun. Got out to do some kayaking and some biking, and it's a beautiful time to be outside in the West. So enjoying that. Hope you're having a good summer as well. Fantastic episode for you today. I'm joined by Bertie Thompson, who is the owner of Pluggable as well as PPC Ninja. And he's been running his business for 15 years, sourcing electronics out of China, which is probably one of the hardest industries, I would imagine, especially as Chinese competition has dramatically heated up over the past years. And he's been able to build an innovative, successful business. And so we dive in today to how he does that. We talk about a lot of things. We talk about the implications for FBA shipments on Amazon going out of China into the United States, what that means for the business and for Western business. We talk about some of the advantages that China has selling against Western merchants. And so kind of lay of the land there, how everything is looking. But then what's hopefully most useful for you is Bernie gets into how he's been able to and how he's continuing to plan to compete against Chinese sellers in a world where Chinese sellers are getting much better at creating Western native brands, or at least brands that look very native. Obviously, they have a massive manufacturing edge. So how in this new world do you compete? That's what we're talking about today. It's a great discussion. He's got a ton of insight here. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I hope you do too. And we're going to kick things off actually with just a quick little teaser talking about how he recently gave up his permanent address, has been doing some fun traveling as just a little appetizer. And we'll get into it right after this. Today's episode is brought to you by the E-Commerce Fuel Private Community, the most vibrant and active discussion forum for owners of seven and eight-figure e-commerce businesses. So how is it any different from other communities online or DTC Twitter? Three big reasons. First, it's vetted. Everyone inside owns a seven or eight-figure business. Average member does about $5 million top line per year. About 15% are doing into the eight figures. You get advice from the owners who have actually been there in the trenches and that you know you can trust it because we vetted them and they're actually doing what they say they are. Secondly, no pitching. There's no affiliate links, no vendors hawking stuff at you. This is just real operators sharing what's working. And then finally, reciprocity is one of our biggest values when we moderate. We require that everyone shares something when they come in so you learn from them, but also we don't let people just come in and strip mine the community for information so you get a really healthy dynamic group. So confident this will be a game changer for your business that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. Join the community, stay for a year, and if you don't see 10x the value relative to your membership fees, we'll refund all of them plus give you $1,000 just for the hassle. So if it sounds interesting, check us out. We'd love to have you apply, and you can learn more at ecommercefuel.com. Looking for help to get the most out of your Shopify store? Don't waste time on theory or untested advice. Instead, download Zipify apps and copy one of the world's most successful Shopify stores. Zipify was created by my friend Ezra Firestone, and you probably know Ezra because he's been a guest on this podcast many times, but he's also the owner of multiple eight and nine figure e-commerce brands, including a $175 million store he built from scratch. And he's created two Shopify apps so you can leverage the same strategies he's using to scale his stores. One-Click Upsell is already the number one upsell app for over 18,000 Shopify stores, including brands like Tushy, Dr. Squash, Buffy, Jones Soda, and Victoria Beckham. And it's so effective that the average One-Click Upsell user boosts their total revenue by 10 to 15% practically overnight. And then there's Zipify Pages. Pages is the most user-friendly landing page builder on Shopify, and it's stacked with over 70 marketing templates so you can quickly generate leads, launch promotions, and drive more sales. And since both apps are tested first on Ezra's own eight and nine-figure stores, you know they actually work. You can try out One-Click Upsell and Zipify Pages for free at zipify.com. That's Zipify.com to try both out for free. Before we get into all the Amazon stuff and the Chinese seller stuff, I've got to ask you, you said that you were excited about travel and kind of being a nomad and you just gave up your permanent address. I got to hear a little bit more about this. Where were you living? Why did you decide to give it up and where are you headed?
Yeah, well, living so I'm actually back at the office for the moment, just for this week. So in Redmond, Washington, not too far from Microsoft headquarters, and that's where I lived in this area for 20 years. Yeah, gave up the lease, became a digital nomad, spending a lot of time in Asia. I've got a kid who's in grad school in Europe, spend time in Europe. So yeah, I got my most of my personal belongings sitting on two pallets in the warehouse. Sold most of it, and that's what's left. So yeah.
I'm guessing, given you only have all of your personal possessions on two pallets, you've pared down pretty substantially. I'm guessing you travel pretty light. What are like the top three things in your travel bag, apart from maybe like, phone and laptop, like, the obvious ones, but what are your top three things that you put in your bag that you are just absolutely essential for you that you, and especially ones that you get like the most bang for the size? I get a disproportionate amount of pleasure and packing light. My wife always laughs at me when we got on an airplane. She's like, "You look so smirky. I know it's because you packed light." He says, "No one cares except for you." And maybe it's true. But anyway, but for you, what are those three things in that category?
Well, I got to go with pluggable products, right? Because actually, other than clothes, it's pretty much just a handful of electronics. Like, I don't carry paper or, really much anything. So, it's my MacBook, it's my USB-C monitor, which pluggable, you're going to see a USB-C monitor from us. I'm carrying around one of our prototypes, a whole, USB-C charger. I have my whole ecosystem is USB-C. So, I have a single charger that covers my MacBook, my phone, my headset, my, Kindle, it's kind of that small digital package. It all fits easily within, the MacBook and the monitor are in the back of the laptop, or in the back of the bag, and then the bottom of the bag. It's a small area that I fill with that electronics.
So I 100% lied. I thought it was going to be the last question, but I got to have two more follow-ups. To Kindle, I hate taking like USB-C, USB regular, the Kindle adapter. Do you have a pluggable product that has one adapter that kind of has adapters for all the different types? Or what's your, is that a product that you sell at Pluggable?
Well, you have to get a newer Kindle that's USB-C, and then you can be USB-C everything, And so, yeah, I've gone with a USB-C everything infrastructure, largely because those chargers are so potentially heavy if you've got a bunch of different ones. And now I just have a pluggable USB-C charger.
And then the external monitor you were talking about, is it similar to like a small iPad, but designed as an external monitor for a MacBook Pro that you could plug into that you sell?
Yeah, it's a 15.6 inch monitor that is just using, USB-C alt mode, and it has USB-C power delivery pass through, so I can plug my power supply into the monitor and then the monitor into my MacBook, and it charges my MacBook and powers the display. That's what we do, and so this is a unique product that we've developed. It's actually tied into the China story. It's developed and produced outside of China.
We'll make sure to link up to that product in the show notes if you want to check it
It
out.
hasn't launched yet, but
Oh, it
yeah.
hasn't. Okay. Go to Pluggable. We'll link
Right,
up to
yes.
Pluggable. Very cool. I have had surprisingly bad luck with USB-C hubs, and the next one I buy will be from you. So it looks like you
Excellent.
got your game dialed in. Well, super excited to talk about a bunch of this stuff. I'd love to start with kind of some new. It may not be, it's not going to be breaking news by the time this airs, but new to us, and you probably know where I'm going with this, but that Amazon just announced recently, this, last day or two, that they're going to be allowing orders from FBA to be fulfilled and shipped from China into the mainland US, competing with Temu and other places. Anyway, I have a thoughts on this, but I'd love to get your reactions to this. You know China really well, Amazon well. We're going to be talking about, all of the advantages that some of the Chinese sellers have, as well as how to combat some of those. But just out of the gates, what do you think about that? What's the impact going to be?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a pretty big impact. This isn't the first time Amazon's doing this. Right now in serving Brazil, Amazon's doing, individual packages into Brazil because of Brazil's high tariff rates on goods. Like for electronics, it's like 70%. So they have a program where they're fulfilling out of the U.S. as long as you fall under their de minimis threshold, which is pretty low. It's like $50 US, including shipping. So that Amazon's threshold is it's got to be a $35 and under product. They're doing it with a bunch of other geographies around the world. So basically, you You had Amazon already doing this, you know, utilizing these de minimis package thresholds to avoid, you know, tariffs, taxes, and also really regulation, because the, you know, these packages are not individually inspected or anything. And then you had Shein and Temu taking a huge amount of market share from Amazon, a big bite out of them, especially in the categories that they focused on. This new initiative by Amazon, it's not every category, like actually in my area, they're not doing electronics yet. I expect they will, but they're doing clothing and a couple of the other things where Shein and Temu have made you know, really big inroads. And yeah, and you know, it's not surprising that Amazon is expanding this out to a much bigger program. I mean, I think it's disappointing. I think Amazon already has reputational risk right now. I talk to a lot of people who go, man, I search on Amazon and it's just all these, you know, crazy five character brands I've never heard of that are dominating search results. And, you know, they all have thousands of reviews. I know those reviews aren't real, but I like the big number, you know. And so anyways, there's a lot of Amazon has a lot of a big body of trust that they've built over the years, but they also have a lot of discontent and concern about whether they are trustworthy. And this initiative will kind of really continue that trend. I mean, Amazon earns trust as being the place to get your stuff at the lowest cost possible, but they're losing trust in some other areas.
Yeah, it's exactly what I was going to ask you on the follow-up, because my thesis is that this just is going to further entrench Amazon as the place where you go to either buy incredibly well-known good brands, Sony, Apple, Toshiba, Nike, or you go to buy really cheap stuff that you don't care, you know, $30, $20 and under, that isn't that critical. And potentially harder in the short term for independent brands that have something unique and proprietary but aren't at a national reputational level. But in the long term, I think it's actually better for real brands that fit that category, because it's going to erode Amazon's trust, which, like you're talking about, I think it's been on the slide for a couple of years. And yeah. And this might be a good pump of adrenaline for them, but I don't see this being a good play for them long term for becoming like the de facto place for e-commerce.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, and so it creates this for you know, those of us building brands, building businesses, it creates this chasm that we've got across, that we're going to come in as a new player and we're going to have all of the mistrust that Amazon has created that we have to battle against. And we're going to be, as we'll talk about, you know, competing against brands from China that have enormous advantages over us in some other ways. And we've got to cross that chasm to becoming a well-known, trusted brand. And, you know, it's tricky because a lot of the strategies to get started as a brand is you start in a niche and, you know, and you focus on solving one little problem. And I believe there's two aspects about establishing a strong brand. One is, you know, doing right by your customers and doing something innovative with the product and being trustworthy. But there's another element, which is, you know, getting awareness and being, like you said, top of mind for some, you know, set of customers. And that's hard in a noisy world. And I think if you, it's quite possible to be a trustworthy company, but not get the awareness and, you know, and you haven't crossed the chasm yet if you're at that.
Yeah. Before we get into kind of the landscape of Chinese sellers and some of the trends that we're seeing there, Pluggable. So Pluggable is your business. You've been running it for 15 years. You know, you've grown for, you know, 13 of those years, maybe had a few headwinds in 2023 and this year, but in general have had a really good track record of growing despite some of the challenges and competition. You've been profitable every year. You sell docking stations, USB hubs, et cetera. Yeah. And anything else to add? I mentioned to you at the very top in the podcast to get people lay the land, but anything else that's good to know about, you know, about Pluggable and that journey that you've taken as we kind of dive into how you've actually been able to compete successfully with China?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing is I didn't know I was starting an Amazon company. I thought I was starting an electronics company in 2009. And you know, there were these two kind of routes to market that bypassed all the gatekeepers, you know, the buyers at Walmart down in Bentonville, Arkansas, and the buyers at Best Buy and all that. And that was Amazon and eBay. And at the time I started in 2009, I didn't know who was going to be the winner. But I love the fact that Amazon had FBA. And, you know, I sent goods in and it's right there at Reno One, you know, the first FBA warehouse. And so my timing was such, it was good timing, lucky timing. But also it meant that what I designed as an electronics business became kind of this Amazon business, just because of that's where the growth was. So I think that's helpful. It's been helpful all along. I mean, at times it's meant that I've been out of step with the tricks people have used to grow. You know, like I, in the early years of Amazon, I was either aware of what was happening and intentionally deciding not to do it, like buying reviews and things like that. Or I was unaware because I wasn't going to conferences and I didn't know, you know, what people were doing to succeed. I was just trying to, you know, sell electronics and provide a better experience, you know, based on my past experiences with electronics and working at Microsoft and IBM on device driver technologies. So now where we're sitting in 2024, you know, I'm having to go back. I mean, in some ways, it's meant that my strategy as a brand hasn't changed radically over the years. We're still just trying to deliver better products, better information around those products, and better support on those products. And that's actually been our mantra for almost the whole 15 years, like ever since we were able to articulate it probably about 10 or 12 years ago. You know, when I think about how do I deal with this really difficult situation with Chinese brands taking in, you know, big chunks of market share, a lot of times it's kind of just kind of figuring out creative ways to take some of those things we've already been doing and do them more, do them better, you know, really double down on some of those things.
Yeah. I mean, when I think about the hardest category to compete with China in, electronics comes to mind at like number one, right? So if you've been able to do this over 15 years, that's pretty telling in terms of the efficacy of your strategy. So before we get into those though, let me paint you a picture of the kind of the competitive landscape with Chinese sellers against Western and especially US focused sellers. Let me know where I have it right, where I have it wrong, and where maybe there's some additional color to add to it. But you've got, you know, I'm stealing this from your presentation, but 2017, about 18% of, you know, the kind of active top sellers on Amazon were out of China or had a Chinese address. That's, you know, today about half, about 50%. You mentioned the cost advantage for Chinese sellers due to the de minimis. They don't have any kind of, you know, as long as the package is under $800, there's no tariffs, no fees, anything. It just comes through. Of course, their manufacturing capability is just light years ahead of what we have. That's, you know, we're just not in some things, there's a couple facets of manufacturing we're really strong at, but in general, they just have such deeper experience and pockets there. And then the other thing too, I think it's worth mentioning is for the first time, I think for a long time, sellers thought, well, Chinese factories are great at creating stuff, but I'm safe because they don't understand necessarily. We've all gotten the instruction books that just, you know, obviously were not written by a native English speaker, or the imagery is funny, or you can just tell there's something off with the branding. But increasingly, I'm talking to people who are saying, man, I've got some very sophisticated in the sense of being able to look very Western or be able to really create brands that resonate and look native for a Western audience. And probably it's a combination of training, becoming more sophisticated, AI, I'm sure helps with language, a lot of different things, but you're seeing that happen much more, that they're getting much better at that. Anyway, that's the broad landscape. What could you add to that? What am I missing and anything I got wrong?
Yeah, you know, I think that starts with the Chinese companies, individuals, government are really good at what they do. They are extremely competitive and they are extremely smart and they are extremely hardworking. You know, so at every level, you know, from the staffer to the company owner to the government, you know, often, you know, providing a significant amount of support in addition to some noise and problems, but a lot of support too. You know, it's a system that is just fundamentally different than what we experience over here in the US and, you know, has proven itself as being, you know, able to outcompete, you know, pretty much, you know, every other supply chain in the world for low cost physical goods. And then you add on top of that, you know, when it comes to winning a sale and growing, you know, they're going to flow like water around any tax, any regulation, any barrier. You know, their mindset is not, okay, what are the rules? You know, let me follow them. Their mindset is, so I'm going to sell this item. how can I find a way through the rules, you know, to achieve my goals? And so, you know, they're more looking at kind of what's actually enforced or what are the practical consequences, not what are the rules as written. And add to that the, you know, okay, so some of the details on that, you know, which is now that they're not all Chinese brands. Of course, the larger ones are not shipping in under the de minimis rule. I mean, you got the small brands and the single packages that are coming in under de minimis, and you've got some mid-sized brands that are shipping into Canada and Mexico and then importing into the US in under $800 chunks. But you also have a lot of the larger brands just simply under declaring the value of their shipments or using HS codes that aren't valid. And one of the crazy things about the global trade system right now is you have governments, whether in Europe or the United States, kind of scrambling to go, you know, having all of our goods produced out of a single country seems like a bad idea. So let's introduce a new regulation, like Europe's been introducing a ton of them, or let's introduce a new tax, like the tariffs that were introduced during the Trump administration. But the thing is Europe's systems, our systems, they're really only designed to enforce things for local companies. What do they do when somebody, you know, under declares the value of goods and they're, you know, there's some company out of Shenzhen? Well, they'll halt their shipments, maybe hold one shipment, but that company in Shenzhen can just come in with a totally different company name on the next shipment. They're untraceable, unreachable. Or what happens if a US state says, hey, this one big seller, this one big brand is not reporting any taxes? If they're a US company, you know, we are found, we are, you know, taken into court, we are, you know, subject to potential criminal liability. If you're sitting in China, you've got none of those risks. You can always come back in a different way. And Amazon, you know, one of the things that's been so frustrating about Amazon is they have a single tool, suspension. Suspend the ASIN, suspend the account, right? Well, you have so many advantages under that system if you're sitting in China. Suspend the ASIN. Yeah, it hurts. It, you know, your inventory that's currently sitting in the US may be impacted, but they have their goods sitting at the factory have a world's worth of markets that they can resell those goods into if something goes wrong with one of their ASINs. If you're a US brand and you've already imported the goods over to the US, you've already paid the tariffs, it is not economical for you to then re-export that somewhere else to sell that good. And of course, in the US, Amazon has dominant market share in many categories of products. Or account suspension. You know, one of the things that's well known is many of the larger, more established Chinese brands have hundreds of Amazon accounts. They curate them, they maintain them. They maintain them for a number of different reasons. One of them is if their main account is suspended, they always have backup accounts. So the effect of this one tool that Amazon has is very different on a US person who is, you know, who can't really set up multiple accounts because they're traceable, they're findable. Whereas somebody, you know, and it would be true of anybody in a foreign country, but the Chinese brands are very aggressive about using, you know, these weaknesses in the systems to make sure that in the end they can sell the product because that's what they care about in the end. They want to be successful. And you know, they're already producing the issue is not product quality. The issue is more, you know, that the all of the obligations we put on companies who bring product to market, if any of those obligations kind of get in the way of them selling the product, they will find a way around those obligations.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always thought about, you know, international trade, macroeconomic trade. You hear about the barriers from a tariff perspective or an increased tax. But one thing I think is more interesting, looks like it's increasingly happening, is the subsidization in different categories or industries. Like you look at the CHIPS Act or the Inflation Reduction Act and the CHIPS Act. Amazing document on that. I knew nothing about that until a couple of months ago. And we effectively, as a government, and I don't think it's a bad idea, like CHIPS is a huge weakness, microprocessors, but we created these, you know, gave these huge subsidies for companies to come and set up in America. And you look at Europe, and Europe's, it seems like, has some concerns there, being like, how we, you know, we're effectively, you know, how are we going to compete with this? This is kind of a reverse tariff. It has the same effective, it has the same effect. It's just the opposite, you know, the opposite approach. In China, are they doing similar things like this? Like, I believe I've heard that financing for inventory or manufacturing, the government offers some pretty advantageous financing terms. Is that correct?
Yeah. There's support at many levels. Actually, in response to the U.S. CHIPS Act, China has their own CHIPS investment that they're making, which is some sort of larger number. And that's for foundries and development of chip houses that can produce the chips. Yeah. So historically, and it's a mix of the Chinese federal government and local governments, all of which, is kind of ultimately financed through debt, by the Chinese federal government, which, by the way, collectively, the Chinese federal and local governments carry an enormous amount of debt that they've invested into their businesses and into their infrastructure like high-speed rail. And someday that might catch up to them, but it hasn't yet. And so classically, one of the tools that was used, and I think this is getting used less, is somebody in China would say, "Hey, I want to get into business, and I want to start an electronics assembly house." The local government goes, "Great! How many people are you going to employ? 1,000 people? Ah, that's great! Electronics, a focus area. It's part of our 5-year plan. Is from the CCP to win in electronics. You're going to have 1,000 people, locally on the payroll." So we're going to use eminent domain to actually seize a bunch of farmers' farmland, and we're going to give it to you to build a factory. And that was very common like 10 or 20 years ago. In fact, most of the urban development in China over the longer period of time has been through that sort of government use of eminent domain. And I'm not clear, how fairly compensated. There's probably some sort of compensation going to the people whose land is being claimed, but we can do no similar thing here. And then the government would actually either historically give the land to the factory in exchange for certain things. Some of the, over time, I think these sorts of arrangements that I've heard of have been getting less and less lucrative. Like a lot of the recent arrangements are things where they give a bunch of things in return for no tax in return for being taxed like 10 or 20 years down the line, with the theory being they're going to build a successful business and later on catch it up with tax revenue. But in the end, essentially they're subsidies. So there's been a lot of the building up of the Chinese manufacturing infrastructure over the last 30 years has been a directed process, intentional, planned, and done really well. I mean, we've never had an economy like the Chinese economy where they have mixed planned and kind of get rich capitalism in a way that's worked so well. It's really worked well for the Chinese. Deng Xiaoping, kind of was the first one to say, "Hey, get rich." And prior to that, that would have been bad thinking, but it's really the Chinese system has been effective.
Hey, Andrew here with a brief intermission to introduce you to Chris Kresser, the founder of AdaptNaturals.com. And I admire Chris for a couple of reasons. One, he's a globally renowned expert in the functional medicine space. And secondly, he's built this business, Adapt Naturals, completely on his own terms. He used to have a much bigger business, shrunk it down so he had more time, energy, and flexibility to spend time outside with his family. Very, very cool entrepreneur. And he's been a member of eCommerce Fuel for a couple of years now. And here's what he has to say about the experience.
Early on, I joined ECF, which I have to say was a huge, like a very great decision, one of the best decisions I made. And because I knew intuitively that like there's a universe of people out there who are way ahead of me in terms of, who've already figured this out, and or at least are further down the path of figuring this out. And They've already experienced and in many cases overcome a lot of the challenges and problems that I know I will be facing as I walk down this road. And I don't need to reinvent the wheel here. And I love the community you've built with ECF Live. I know firsthand how much work goes into building a community, and one especially that where people there's so much mutual respect and just a real ethic of people helping each other out and being like, rising tide lifts all boats. And I really feel that in ECF Live. And I think that starts from the top. So kudos to you for doing that. And it's been an enormous help for me. And like I said, it exposed me to so many people that I've become good friends with and they've become colleagues and have helped the Adapt Naturals to thrive. So thank you for that.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8 figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show.
So we've talked a lot about the headwinds and the doom and gloom, at least from Western sellers, if you're trying to compete against China. I'd love to talk about how you've successfully been able to compete and how you're going to continue to think about competing in this environment. And the first one I'd love to talk about is kind of your thoughts on unique selling propositions. And I don't think this is going to be a revolutionary one, but the meme, I don't know if you've seen that. I'm sure you've seen the meme where there's like four doors, the agent of death or the Grim Reaper is going to each one, right? And I feel like before it was like drop shipping and now, you know, then it was, you know, the private label, just basic private label and products that are Me Too products. And those are at a point where you said this in your presentation. I think it's, you know, people have been pretty aware of this for a while. Those are just not going to fly anymore. You got to do something different. So talk, if you would, a little bit about how even in a world where USPs are going to get copied relatively quickly, or at least on a medium term or intermediate basis, you're still using them to compete well.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think there's always been a kind of a 2x2 grid of, you know, the amount of initial investment that you have to make in a product and how much of a uniqueness that buys you in the market and for how long, you know, you're able to maintain that uniqueness. So really for the first 10 years of the Amazon explosion, let's call it last decade, your best bet as a new brand was to not invest a ton in that new product development, because there was just so much opportunity in terms of getting product onto Amazon, getting it out there. There was not yet over competition. And then, you only had a limited amount of uniqueness. A lot of your uniqueness was kind of cosmetic on the surface, maybe the information and the marketing and stuff, but that was enough. And so this, you know, where you can succeed on that grid has shifted. That sort of stuff where your product is fundamentally commodity and you're differentiating yourself through marketing and information, it's not that there's no opportunity there, but you've either got to be really good or really lucky to make that work. It's not a no-brainer at all anymore. In most categories of product, there's extreme over-competition right now, you know, driven by largely the Chinese brands, but also, you know, non-Chinese brands too. So then you got to, what do you do in response? Well, you go for more of a unique selling proposition, but that takes investment. You know, you've got to go, you know, research the market, identify an idea that triangulates all the different challenges of creating a new product, you know, that there's market need for your solution, you know, that you've got capability as a company to go do it, that the competitors are not yet there. You identify, you know, those USPs that you're going to go after, but then you're going to have to invest in those, because if they're the unique, then your supply chain is not going to pay for the development of those things. So now you're spending time on patents. Now you're paying a patent lawyer. Now you're going to a factory and not just buying what they already have on the shelf. You're going to them and saying, hey, I've got this RFQ, you know, to develop this whole, you know, new product, and it's going to be tooling that's just for me and maybe a PCB that's just for me. And then, you know, I talk about some important, you know, advanced strategies of also not just going to one factory. You actually have to spread your work among several factories so that no one of them knows how to make your product. Well, that's great, but that's also more time and more investment, you know, to you know, kind of find those supply chain elements to deliver you a unique product with protection, you know, from immediate copying, that then, you know, now you can bring to market and you finally find out, you know, for most of us, not every product's a hit. So you're going to make this big investment. And then, you know, one out of four of those big investments are really going to pay off. And the other ones are just going to be, you have to be accepted as either losses or maybe break evens. Yeah. So it's changed. You know, I think the game has fundamentally changed. If somebody's trying to build a brand around commodity products, it's enormously tough today. And so we all have to, you know, think about differentiation, uniqueness, IP protection, and all of those issues.
Could you walk me through an example? You talked about the multiple factories to protect IP theft. So if you just have one, they're going to see it. They're going to be able to take that, sell it to other places. And I think, you know, much more likely that's going to get out somewhere else. And you're going to see your exact product on Alibaba or Temu or something like that. Walk us through an example, if you would, of how that looks to break your product into, you know, two or three factories so that they're all unaware. And then, you know, how that supply chain looks from building them in different factories and then bringing them together to assemble them for final product. What would be an example?
Right. Yeah, I'll do two quick examples. Let's do one that's non-electronics and one that's electronics. So for non-electronics, a lot of times it really just comes down to tooling. So, you know, that you've got some sort of mold or plastic injection, you know, that you're doing for some part of the product. Or maybe it's a process, you know, some sort of glossing or glazing or something, you know, that's a hard to do element or requires some sort of initial investment. So, you know, what you want to do is you basically want to have, let's say your injection molding be done by a pure injection molder that you ship the goods somewhere where you don't have that factory talking with your assembly factory. So you probably even have a third place that you ship that to, and then you blind ship that to where you're finally going to assemble. Because if you have them directly talking, you haven't gained much, you know, by having that split. You know, and what's interesting about that particular example is, you know, other than the work it takes you to establish two trustworthy factory relationships, which is a lot of work, it's not all that different than how the supply chain would have worked anyway. Like if you had gone to that one assembly factory and used them as original design manufacturer, you know, chances are the company doing the assembly is actually going out for the injection molding anyway. So they were, you know, the actual flow of goods looks the same. It's just that you are the one establishing the relationships and you're trying to do everything possible to not have the other party learn who the other is. And that way, that assembly house or that injection molder will have difficulty. It won't be impossible, but they'll have difficulty selling that same design or producing that same design for somebody else. In complex products like we do, like electronics, you have more challenges in terms of finding suppliers and quality, but you also have more opportunities. Like, let's just pick a simple opportunity. Almost every piece of electronics today has firmware. You got the chips, yeah, you got the PCB, but each of those chips often has a firmware build that's loaded on it during production. And so one of the great and easy separations is you physically manufacture the hardware in one place, often with kind of a default or dummy firmware, and then you actually ship it somewhere else to have your real software load into the firmware. And you have those separated. And actually, we haven't done this, but some people could potentially even do that in the United States, you know, that you do a firmware flash in the US where you really have visibility and control and no back channel talking in order to protect the product. So I think each product area is different, but we have to find those ways. Because if you're sourcing from a single factory, I think it's just a matter of time before that factory either themselves is directly selling that same product back on places like Amazon, or that they are, you know, going out to other customers, and the other customers, you know, they told them, you know, we're just selling in China, and they say, okay, we'll do something special for you, we'll produce it for you. But you know, the reality is that as soon as goods are on the market, they go wherever the money is, and so they'll end up competing with you on Amazon.
Yeah, how, going back to the kind of creating products with that are unique and differentiated, there's a lot of work. Ton of process, especially if you're having to do that every 18 to, you know, 24 to 30 months, which is, I'm guessing, ballpark a life cycle for that, maybe longer. Any tips or suggestions on creating a process to be able to go through and do that? Because if to do this effectively, you've got to reinvent the wheel or reinvent a new wheel every, you know, couple of years. So how do you do that in your company? Because you have a long track record of doing that. There's a lot in there, but a couple key things that you focus on to kind of make that a repeatable, to make innovation a repeatable process?
Yeah, I think there's no magic answer. One thing we're doing is we're using way more AI, you know, for the brainstorming, for identifying market gaps, for then articulating and communicating what we're intending to do to fill that market gap. Like one recent patent that I worked on, I was thinking about it for a few months, and then I just sat down one Saturday morning with ChatGPT and did up, you know, a provisional patent where, you know, I said, give me an outline, with this idea. And then I went section by section saying, now correct this section to include these elements, don't include these other elements, and basically did that through the sections. And then I handed that to my patent attorney and said, can we turn this into a provisional? And the patent attorney, you know, saw what I had done. You know, I said what I had done, and he was just blown away. He's like, this is remarkable. It's not ready to file. We've got to do some work on this. But basically, I cut the amount of a lawyer time on getting that provisional through probably to about one fifth of what it would have been had we done it the normal way. Because the normal way is you sit on a call, you have a conversation, the lawyer asks you a lot of questions, they go away for a few days and spend a lot of billable hours, you know, writing up what you said. You know, this is just way, way faster. So that's a good, you know, kind of a process tip. But a lot of it in the end, I think, comes down to having the right, you know, for whatever your products are, having the right experience in the organization. And then still that last step to, you know, whoever your downstream partners are, essentially you have more downstream partners now, because you're not just getting to work with one factory that does everything for you. You're having to get to that next level of depth and work and be the coordinator working with a bunch of different factories. And you've got to have the talent in your organization and the time, you know, to be able to do that. So it's, I'm not, you know, this is not easier than like the world we had 10 years ago where you could just launch stuff and succeed. That was a better world for us. This is a harder world, but, you know, there are ways.
Talk a little bit, if you will, about the Amazon Patent Evaluation Express program. I hadn't heard about that. And I always had thought, yeah, if you have a patent, especially if you're trying to enforce it against, even if you're trying to enforce it in, you know, the same country you're operating, it can be challenging. You got to put the money and the lawyers behind it. But, you know, if you're trying to enforce it with someone overseas in China selling, good luck, it's not going to happen. But that sounds like it may not be the case, or maybe a chance to be able to actually use that patent after all. Can you talk about that program and how it works?
Yeah, I mean, 20 years ago, I'm at Microsoft, and, you know, I'm getting pulled into, you know, various patent issues. And, you know, at that time, 20 years ago, patents were just a big company game. You know, they it was like mutually assured destruction. You know, they would just build up these big portfolios, and then they would threaten each other with these big portfolios, and then they'd come up with some grand settlement for, you know, a few hundred million dollars going one direction or the other. And then for small companies, patents were almost useless until you died. And I'll try to explain why that is. So when you're small, the expense of enforcing or defending patents means that any big guy can crush you at any time, because they have a ton of patents that whatever it is that you're selling, they'll have something that infringes that, and then they'll use that as leverage to kill your effort to go after them. And so then only when a company has nothing left to lose, when they're no longer operating, then they become what's called a patent troll, you know, that I've got nothing to lose. You can't threaten me with your patents anymore. So now the little companies can go after the big guys and try to extract some blood, you know, for their patents. Well, that's basically how the patent system worked until Amazon. And Amazon fundamentally changed the game, because Amazon went and grabbed a ton of market share, you know, like in electronics, probably 80% market share in the United States. And then they said, well, if somebody accuses somebody else of patent infringement, we're going to do the one thing we know how to do, which is just suspend the ASIN right away. And that's what they started doing 10 or 12 years ago. You know, that was suddenly gave small patent holders a ton of power. Now, the system has evolved, I think, actually in pretty good ways since then. Now, it's not just an accusation, they'll take it down. They've got this new, or not new, it's a program that's been through a few iterations, but this, you know, this neutral evaluation process, where if I believe somebody's infringing my patent on a product, I'm going to have to plunk down, I think it's $3,000 right now with Amazon, and through brand registry, the accusation or the paperwork or the complaint. And then that seller is going to also have to plunk down the same amount, $3,000. And then Amazon's going to use a part of that money to actually go out to a third-party attorney to evaluate the merits. And their decision is final. If that third-party attorney decides that one side is right, that the patent's valid and there's an infringer, then you will, that ASIN will stay down and you will get your money back, and the one who is accused will lose the money. If you as the patent holder lose, you know, that accusation or whatever you want to call it, or complaint, then you lose your $3,000. But it actually, you know, so it's, you know, it's a little bit complex. You say $3,000, that sounds like a lot, but I mean, you've already spent probably $10,000 to $30,000 getting your patent. So $3,000 to enforce it, if you believe your patent's enforceable, is really a bargain. And it really puts small businesses in the game of actually using their intellectual property for what it was originally intended for, which is to protect your innovations. So I think it's another way of putting it is it's really increased the value to companies that sell on Amazon of getting patents.
Yeah. And is that a pretty new program? How long has that been around for?
You know, I think in its current named form, it's been like 2 years, but and some of the details have changed, but it actually existed in a prior form for, I think, another 2 or 3 years before that. So I think it's been around for about 5 years or so.
Great. And then the last one I thought was fascinating, and we'll get to a few more, but the one that I thought was very unusual and probably haven't heard about. Can you talk about regulated products in terms of capture and escape and how you can use those to kind of create moats against other sellers?
Yeah. So, you know, the way I think of it is a grid of 4x4 of saying, is it a high regulation, low regulation geography? And then is it highly enforced or not enforced at all? And, you know, I think that the most dangerous quadrant in that, surprisingly, is high regulation and low enforcement. Because what happens in this world of cross-border selling and all these Chinese brands is, unless you're willing to be as dishonest as the next company, you're going to get blown out in those geographies where it is high regulation but low enforcement, because they're going to get the product to market without doing all the expense and all the work. You know, low regulation, low enforcement is a nice level playing field. And also high regulation with high enforcement can be a nice level playing field, and probably one that's not that appealing to the Chinese brands, because they'd rather go to the low enforcement quadrant. You know, so areas like, you know, in the US, you know, medical and military, you know, they've long been one of the few areas where US manufacturing is still, you know, kind of strong. And I think it'll remain that way moving forward. The trouble with that is it's also not great alignment with Amazon. Like, if you're thinking you're an Amazon seller and you're thinking you're going to do military or medical, well, you've got an issue there. So yeah, so I just think there's interesting challenges right now, because there's a lot happening globally with tax and regulatory. And I do think you need to think globally. If you're not thinking globally, you're leaving too much oxygen. Your Chinese brand competitors are thinking globally. And so if you're not, you know, you're just going to set yourself up where you don't have the scale that they do. And that's ultimately going to cause problems for you.
You had mentioned another tactic was selling to specialized customers, which I think kind of breaks down to retail and wholesale, if you had to generalize. Has that been a pretty big component of your strategy with Pluggable? And what percentage of your sales go through those routes?
Yeah, it's been a really big component of our strategy. It's an uphill battle, man. Amazon's been just taking market share from a lot of traditional channels. Even, you know, Amazon has big pushes with B2B into education and government and things like that. So it really feels like you're paddling against the current when you're going back into those markets and selling in traditional ways. But we've been doing, you know, we definitely have had a push there. We've been very Amazon dependent for most of our life as a company. We've reduced that Amazon dependence over the last 2 or 3 years. It's not anywhere near where I'd like it to be. I mean, we're still, you know, basically about 70% Amazon dependent, but we were 90% Amazon dependent 5 years ago. So, yeah, and a lot of it is there's just there's a diversity of other ways to go to market. A lot of them, you know, are essentially, in one way or another, selling directly to businesses, directly to government, or directly to education. And then the way you sell directly to those different audiences can really vary, you know, depending on the type of company, the type of government, and their particular procurement rules, and then the type of education environment. And so if you can establish those sales relationships, if you can establish the right way to talk to those audiences and reach them, you have a really nice protection at the moment from most of the Chinese brands. Not all of them, like, you know, one of the brands that we compete with, there's just an amazing brand and also a brutal brand to compete with is a brand called Anker. You know, they're mm-hmm. they're public in the Chinese markets, well known. You know, they don't leave any market stone unturned. Like, they are, you know, government sales in the US, you'd think they wouldn't, you know, have the chutzpah to do that, but absolutely they're doing that, you know. And you know, so you really, but for the moment, for the most part, in most market, in most product segments, if you go into those specialized markets, you're going to have a lot of shelter from this wave of competition from Chinese brands.
You've mentioned that the last year, 2023, 2024, I'm guessing, I could be wrong, were years where growth slowed down or maybe even stalled or reversed a little bit. It's a hard time out there right now for merchants. You know, there's a handful that are doing really well. I'd say on average, just between inflation, I was talking about this with my team earlier today. It's funny because you look at the stock markets and they're all-time highs, or at least they're recording are very close, but your average consumer is not doing as well, nearly as well, and just not spending as much. Anyway, all that said, what do you think on your side is causing that slowdown in growth and sales? And what do you plan on really doubling or tripling down on to try to fix that going forward?
Right. Yeah. I mean, some of it is really specific to our business. Like, the, you know, last year we had a historic low in PC sales. And as a brand, we have a lot of attached to PCs. So, you know, there's a hope out there that the AI PC wave probably in 2025 is going to fix that. But but outside of, you know, some of those specifics in our area, it really is this issue that Amazon has eaten the world and China has eaten Amazon. And Amazon has been pushed further into, you know, being China focused by the direct competition from Chinese marketplaces like Temu and Shein. So they've really doubled down on, you know, that their focus on China. You know, Amazon only has a single country of origin that they support with Amazon Global Logistics. That's China. You know, they only have, well, at least at the beginning of this year, they only had one country where they had innovation centers and were running regular trainings and conferences. That's China. Now, they might be I think they're going to expand those out elsewhere in Asia, you know, through the rest of the year, although AGL is not expanding out yet. And then, of course, you know, there's the new direct to China marketplace that we talked about at the beginning of the call. So, you know, I think those. So in a sense, what's been happening is Western brands that had an extra margin layer because, you know, we were sourcing from, you know, as long as we're sourcing from China and selling on Amazon, we're just somebody, from Amazon's point of view, we're just margin that they want to get rid of. And they've been working to do that. And so I think we've been feeling those effects. You know, and another way of looking at that is the Amazon flywheel. You know, what's the Amazon flywheel? You know, this is this brilliant, simple model that Amazon has been executing to for more than 20 years of, you know, you get more customers who attract more sellers who compete harder against each other, which causes lower prices, you know, which attracts more customers. And so it's been 20 years of so Amazon experiences that as a flywheel effect of energy building up. We as brands experience that as a screw turning tighter and tighter each year. And that screw, you know, 20 years on is pretty tight.
When you look out, let's say 5 years is a long time in e-com, but you've been doing it for 15 years. So, and you've got a good imagination. What percentage of your, do you think Amazon is going to make up a meaningful percentage of your business in 5 years? Let's say, do you think Amazon is going to make up 50% of your business in 5 years?
Yeah, I think it still will, you know, because we're still either going to have IP protected differentiated product that's going to sell well everywhere. And so that'll be some of that 50%. And I think 50% is probably a right number. Or we'll be lucky, you know, that we've done all the right things on Amazon. We've made the stars align and we've actually gotten lucky. We've you know, sustained a high search position and we beat off the competitors. But then for a really big part of our product line and probably for something like 50% of our revenue, it will not be those things. And though it'll be, you know, not enough unique selling proposition, you know, no ability to defend ourselves against this, you know, over competition on Amazon. and will not be getting much revenue from Amazon, but there still are opportunities to get revenue elsewhere. So I think for us, that sort of 50-50 is realistic.
Yeah. And then you also, I mean, of course you have Pluggable, but you have a business called PPC Ninja as well. Can you talk a little about that? Like how, you know, first how it started and then, give people a sense of what you do, how it can help them, et cetera.
Yeah. So I'm a founder of the company. It came out of our efforts. So we started with Amazon advertising right at the beginning, 2013. So while other people were buying reviews, we were already paying Amazon for ads. Like I did the wrong thing. I did the stupid thing. So that led to a lot of experience with Amazon advertising. And so, you know, by 2018, we were looking at spinning that off. We also had another kind of bunch of software tools we had spun off, but we spun PPC Ninja off, focused on Amazon advertising. And so what it's become today is a piece of software that's focused on sellers, agencies, and brands who know advertising, because ours is a, you know, a tool designed for people like us who know what they're doing and want to be able to get all of their historical data in one place, be able to get views that are highly actionable about, you know, where the outliers lie in their data, and then easily taking action on those outliers with bulk actions. And then Ritu Java, who's the CEO of the company, she also has a, you know, do it all for you consulting agent or software services agency, ad agency, where we'll manage everything for you. And we happen to use the software underneath, but it's basically we'll manage the whole ad account. And so, you know, I feel really good about our skill at what we do, our strength at what we do with PPC Ninja. I mean, obviously Pluggable uses it, you know, ourselves. We're kind of the lead customer on it. And if it wasn't for, you know, the really good job we do in advertising, we would not have been able to compete in this really tough category. Really, Amazon advertising is the primary way beyond, you know, better products, better information, better support, which is our Pluggable mantra. It's the advertising strength combined with those things that has allowed us to survive really the 15 years.
And you got to be good at a lot. You got to be good at advertising, marketing, product development, importing, leading a team, logistics. It's a heavy skill set to do well. And congrats on 15 years of that on PPC Ninja. And thank you for coming on. This was, I mean, probably one of the most like information dense, and I say it in the best possible way, you know, discussions I've had on the podcast in a while. I think it's something that's people have kind of known about for a while and starting to see, but it's, if you're not feeling it now as a Western seller, you're going to, you know, be feeling it pretty acutely pretty soon. So anyway, just really appreciate you coming on, and the best places for people to find you, PPC Ninja and Pluggable. Can you just give the URLs for those if people want to check out that service? And then also if they want to, if they're like me and they have a terrible USB hub and they need something upgraded that actually works, you know, and doesn't drop stuff, tell us where to get it.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for Pluggable, it's Pluggable with one G, pluggable.com. And for PPC Ninja, it's ppcninja.com. And would love to hear from you. My name is Bernie. I'm the first name at both of those domain names. So reach out anytime.
Amazing. Well, Bernie, it's been super helpful and a lot of fun. Congrats on what you've built. And yeah, appreciate so much you coming on. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me on. Andrew, it was great.
That's going to do it for this week. A big thank you to OneClick Upsell, who offers incredible upsell software to get more from every single customer and increase your average order value on your site. To make more money from the customers you already have, check them out at ecommercefuel.com/upsell. And if you own a 7 or 8 figure store, you really should be a part of our private community and forums here at eCommerce Fuel, where you can connect with over 1,200 store owners just like you. We're so confident it'll be a game changer that we offer a 10x ROI guarantee. If you don't see 10x your membership value in the first year, we'll refund you 100% of your membership fees plus toss in an extra $1,000 for the hassle. So you can learn more and apply at ecommercefuel.com. Thanks so much for listening. Work hard, adventure often, and look forward to seeing you again next Friday.